Hello.
Hello, is this Nestor?
He sure is.
John Denver calling.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. I'm a little late, I beg your pardon.
Oh, it's fine, fine indeed. I actually was a little late waking up and getting my my stuff together as far as reading your stuff and getting some questions. How extensive is your tour this summer? I understand you were in Rhode Island the other day, but you're home now, right?
Yeah, I've got 5 days off. I've been on since about the last week of July, and except for these 5 days, all of July and a couple days of August. That's about all I'm doing in this country. There's a few other concerts in that are scattered out at the end of August and September.
Right, you're playing Wolf Trap in September, I know.
Yeah, right.
Go ahead.
Then I'm off to Japan in the end of September and Europe in October and November.
Yeah, how popular are you in those countries as far as, you know, the size of the venue you play in?
Well, sort of like I am here. There are some places where I have really large audiences. Everywhere I play halls that have, 2,000 or 3,000, 4,000 people, and I have a very loyal following.
Is it like when you go to a place like Japan, do a lot of Americans show up at the shows?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's I figured as much. It seems like a lot of the rock bands I talk to say the same thing. They say it's all army people, and we go over there. So as far as putting a show together, I've seen you twice now, and I saw you last summer, and I love the show. Is it the same show, your songs? Or?
No, this is a pretty different show. Coming into Baltimore and at Wolf Trap, I'm going to be solo without my band, just me and the guitars, and I use the string quartet in the second half of the program for about 8 or 9 songs. I have some new songs introducing from a new album that's coming out in September and like that.
Okay. Yeah, I was just wondering, when you put a set list together, what do you put in and what do you take out, and why do you play certain songs and not other songs? And it must be really difficult having, 29 albums now?
Yeah, I got 29 albums now. 30 will be this new one.
What's the new one going to be called?
Huh?
What is the new one called?
It's called Different Directions.
Different Directions, okay.
There's a song on the album called Two Different Directions about a relationship, and then there's, Different Directions on a lot of different levels, lyrically and musically. There are some songs that have a little stronger edge to them, I think, than I've done in the past.
Like rock songs, or?
Pretty close to rock and roll, yeah.
Now, with all your traveling and your activism and all that, when do you find time to still sit down and, you know, be John Denver from 1970 and write music? And
well, it's it seems to be more difficult these days sometimes, and I've never been one who has sat down and worked every day at writing a song. You know, when the songs come or when there's an idea that you have for a song, which, funny enough, quite often happens when they're traveling, then I'll sit down and work on that to see if I can make a whole thought. And when the song is important, when you get one that's happened for you, you find the time to do that. You make it work.
So these songs get written on airplanes?
No, not on airplanes. I write a lot of songs in my head when I'm driving or when I'm walking. It's happened a couple times in flight en route between cities, but more often in cars, and sometimes it'll be just the start of an idea, a verse or a chorus or like that, and then it's sitting down with a guitar, the piano, and working on it.
How often do these writing modes sort of strike you? I mean, is this something you do at least once a week, or is this something that happens every couple months?
I wouldn't say it's that often. I only have 4 songs on the new album. There were a lot more that I had available, but they just didn't fit the album the way it ended up. And the 4, one of them is actually 3 songs, is Bluegrass Symphony, or Suite, that I wrote. So it's kind of like that.
Okay. Now, with the environmental issues and things like that, when did you become active? I mean, when during your childhood did you, you know, start to observe the planet and say, we got problems here with throwing trash away and we're shooting bad things into the sky and putting bad things
in the water? A little louder.
I'm sorry. When during your childhood did you find out about environmental issues? When did you really start to become an activist?
Well, I don't think it's that I found out about environmental issues. What happened, I was an Air Force brat. And when we moved to Arizona, this is where I started about the first grade, second grade, And from then on, whenever my family moved, I really enjoyed being outdoors, whether it was the desert in Arizona or the woods in Alabama or the prairies out around Fort Worth, Texas. I just really enjoyed being outdoors and in the woods, and I was kind of shy. And so I spent a lot of time by myself. And when I started to write songs, like the first song I ever wrote was called Sitting on the Banks of a Lazy Little Stream. And it was at a church camp in Arizona. And I was 13 years old, if I remember correctly. And so what happened when I started to try and express myself and started writing songs, a lot of my images came from nature. And then as I began to be a little bit more aware of life beyond myself and my own growing up, then I began to be aware of environmental issues and certainly had a very strong vision of a direction that we were going environmentally, where there were going to be real problems if people didn't start paying a different kind of attention to nature. And so I found myself, as I was becoming successful, and able to do something with music, and I think there's another part here too, which is when I joined the Mitchell Trio. I think it's really the first time I became socially and politically aware, and found out that there were aspects in those areas that had to do with the environment and with nature, and that music could have an impact on some of those things. It could have an impact on people. It could have them. It could give them a different perspective about a certain issue. It could give them some humor in a satirical way about some things that were going on, and could be sometimes moving enough to have people be inspired to take a different kind of action than they might ordinarily have taken out of hearing a song or a point of view expressed through music that moves them. And so all of that just kind of kept growing in my life. You know, I think I've been involved in environmental issues for over 25 years now.
Now, do you get frustrated by the intensity of the whole thing and how, you know, we see it on TV now, Earth Day, and I know you have Earth Day every day, and I mean, do you get frustrated by people who just would throw trash out on the street? I mean, it's not that hard to see. I mean, you can go probably anywhere. And...
Well, yeah, I guess one of the greatest frustrations in the world, and I think it exemplifies how we think about the environment, is the amount of litter you see everywhere. You know, if people would just take the time to throw their trash in a trash can or someplace where it can be recyclable, and if people would just take a moment a day to look around them someplace and pick up a piece of trash, then I think that would show a greater sensitivity to nature in a very positive way, and could support a commitment to doing something positive about our environment. I think that people, as much as we are doing more and more recycling, we are being more conscious about how much energy we're using and what we're doing with energy in our homes, I still don't think that people get that we are an endangered species. You know, the people that I talk to say that in all likelihood, in this decade, in this last decade of the 20th century, that we are very liable to determine whether or not the Earth remains inhabitable by higher life forms, such as human beings.
Do you think, on the whole, I mean, that the education level and the intelligence level is there to make this change happen? I mean, do you feel like sometimes it's just so darn fruitless, you know, that...
Talk a little bit louder.
Do you feel like sometimes it's just so darn fruitless that you're trying and you're trying, but it's not going to be accomplished in your lifetime?
What I just said is that I think it's got to be accomplished in our lifetime. The changes that we have to make, the recognition of what's going on and how critical it is, has to happen in our lifetime, Master. And we're not going to be the ones who are going to end up doing the job. But out of what we do now, out of the choices that we make, and out of how we educate our children and inspire our children to recognize that they can have the world that they would like and the one that we would have liked, is our job.
Mm. Okay.
And, you know, one of the things that I look at, I think the most critical thing in the world right now is that we have a generation of young people who do not have a vision of a better life, that it can get any better than this. I think they think it's going downhill. Why get an education? Why worry about it? We're such a material society in this country, and in the way we lead the world, the way that we influence the world through arts and the movies and everything else, we're teaching the whole rest of the world to be materialistic. And if we just leave it that way, I say we're on a downward spiral now. And if we turn it over to them lacking a vision or a sense of possibility that it can be better, then I think that we're writing ourselves off.
Okay, tell me about the Windstar Foundation. And
Windstar Foundation is a nonprofit educational foundation. Our stated purpose is to be a catalyst for responsible action for a sustainable future and a healthy environment. And that's just what I was talking about.
Right, exactly.
What we're trying to do is to be a catalyst out there to, one, move people, to educate people, to move people to action, and to do so in a way that creates a sustainable future and a healthy environment.
All right. On to a new topic. Tell me about the Hunger Project. I saw in the notes that you're the founder. Is that correct?
I can't hear you.
I'm sorry. I can hear you perfectly, so I just keep thinking you can hear me. Tell me about the Hunger Project as far as you're a founder of that.
I'm one of the founders of the Hunger Project. I've been absent for the last couple of years. I've been working so hard with Windstar and on environmental issues, so I'm not up to date with where things stand with the Hunger Project. But we say that a world without hunger is possible, that it can be done. Our commitment is to create that as a reality by the end of this century. And we believe that it has to do with individuals making a difference, individuals, you know, taking a stand for the end of hunger. And that's, you know, totally compatible. I think that the end of hunger and a healthy environment are totally compatible. You're not going to have one without the other. I think that the end of hunger and a healthy environment and a sustainable future and the conscious use of energy resources and the resolution of conflict between peoples and nations, I think all of these things are the same issue, really.
Okay. Now, you took a tour of Africa, did you not?
I was in Africa, golly, about 1985, I think it was.
Right when all the Live Aid thing was happening?
It was before Live Aid.
Before Live Aid. Now, what did you see, and how did it make you a different person? I mean, I see video, and every time I see it, I feel like I'm a different person.
Well, it's the thing that we didn't see in the videos that I was most moved by is that there are people over there who are turning things around. It's like the Peace Corps and some of the other developmental agencies and relief organizations are working a little bit differently. And the people themselves in the villages are looking at things differently. Initially, we went in there and said, this is what you've got to do. And they said, these people say this is what we've got to do. And so that's what they did. And very rarely did that work out. And what was happening now is that more and more the people themselves are saying, this is what we need to do in our community. And will you help us do this? And so it's the example was, you know, a lot of education before it happens, before a kid gets in the first or second grade and starts learning how to read. And most of the countries in Africa at that time, well, at this time, are less than 25, around 25 years old. And they're just beginning to learn how to read. So a whole lot of education has happened, and now it's starting to move forward in a more significant way. You know, there are countries in Africa who are now exporting food and grain, which was not true 5 years ago.
Right.
So things are turning around, and we're trying to find where those kind of activities are taking place in the Hunger Project and support those people and also let the rest of the world know about it. And, you know, have the people on both sides of this living not not in the futility of hunger, but in the possibility of the end of hunger.
Okay. Now, I remember a few years ago, you had links with the space program, and there was talk of you becoming an astronaut. Now, how close did that come to happening? And I know you had said that you wanted to, but did you ever get close?
Well, I was a catalyst for the whole Citizen of Space program getting started in this country, and had been assured of a flight when we had the Challenger accident. And I think that put, a private citizen flying in space way on the back burner, almost non-existent at this point. Around that, I received an invitation from the Soviets to fly in their space program, and I had a flight scheduled a year ago, last December the 18th, and had all kind of stuff going on. You know, the Soviets charge everybody $10 million to fly in their program, and governments have stepped forward and paid this for the cosmonauts that they have, the citizens that they have put into the cosmonaut program to fly for one reason or another, the most recent being a British lady. And I had a circumstance where I was getting all of that waived, although that's not the story that hit the press. What the press said was that I had offered the Soviets $10 million to fly in space. And so that was not at all true and wasn't going to happen that way. In any case, my wife became pregnant, and I chose to let that flight go at that time to be with her during a pregnancy and during the birth of our baby. And I don't know if that'll come around again. It's been interesting this year. I've had the chance to talk to quite a few organizations, and it's come up about, you know, why I wanted to fly in space. And why I wanted to fly in space is about 1,000 different reasons, but mostly it's connected to that thing I was saying earlier about young people not having a vision of a better future. I think that that we have to find a way to reach them, and I think that the space program is one of the ways to do that, to get them excited about education and also to give them a different perspective, not only of the future, but of what's going on here on planet Earth. And I think someone who has the kind of celebrity that I have and the experience in other areas that I do, that there would be a great opportunity to do something around that kind of endeavor that could possibly reach young people all over the world. And that's what I was going for.
Are you regretful that you didn't take the opportunity? I mean, not everybody gets the opportunity, and almost no one turns it down.
Well, no, I'm not regretful. You know, I don't try not to live with too many things that are a source of regret in my life. That's just the way the things turned out, and I think I did the right thing over here from where I sit. And people have asked me if I would try to go again, and I actually am still very, very interested in it. I don't know if I have the energy to get that whole ball rolling again, but I do have a couple of situations that have come out, as I said, out of these talks this spring, where I'm going to take a pretty hard look at it. See if it is possible.
So out of all the things, you know, John Denver, the entertainer, the tour person, the musician, the studio musician, you know, the actor, what gives you the most pleasure at this point?
Well, it's not any one of those things, you know. It's all of them. I guess the thing that gives me the most pleasure right now, outside of my my children, is the fact that I'm in a position in my life and in my career where there really is the opportunity to do anything that I want to do, to work in whatever area, still have concerts, still making records, and still writing songs. I'm doing television shows. There's the opportunity to do films. I can really take it anywhere I want to, and that's very, very exciting. Very pleasing.
What happened with RCA? When did you go off the label?
Well, RCA, I think what happened, you know, it's more complex than what I'm going to say, but this is a major part of it. RCA went through a whole bunch of changes. The record company was in trouble itself. There were a lot of changeovers going in the administration of the company and in people out in the field. It got sold to General Electric for a while, and subsequently sold to BMG in Germany. And during the process of all of that, I think that that I had an enormous, maybe the best contract that RCA has ever put out, and maybe one of the best in record company history. Not Michael Jackson's most recent one for sure, but still a very, very good contract. And with the amount of sales that I had every reason to expect another contract as good as that, if not better. And at that time, my record sales were dwindling. There was nobody with RCA anymore who had been connected with my success. And they were looking at an enormous expenditure for me to sign a contract, and they didn't want to do that. And at the same time, over where I sat, there was nobody there who was working for me.
Right.
And this is a very competitive business, and you need somebody out there who's really working for you and who believes in you. And that was simply not the case at RCA anymore, and so it was a perfect time to part company.
Now, Windstar's your own baby. Who distributes this thing for you then?
American Gramophone.
Okay. That's good. I mean, the distribution is the hardest part when you go in and ask for the new John Denver record and they don't have it. Is that possible because of American Gramophone not being as big as RCA? Or?
Well, I think that it's taken some work, but the thing I'm excited about most with American Gramophone is twofold. One is I do have a company here that that really likes me, believes in me, and is working for me, and has the wherewithal to get that product out there. And so I anticipate that we're going to have a larger kind of record success than I have in quite a few years because of how all of this is coming together. That doesn't mean I'm going to be the biggest selling record artist in the world again, and I don't know if I'm going to have hit records again, but I know that I have a huge audience out there still, and I know that that I'm singing better than I ever have before. I think much of the new material I've written over the last 5 years is as good, if not better, than anything I wrote before. At least that's the kind of response it gets in my concert audiences. And I think I'm going to have record success again.
Do you, now that you're off RCA, do you pretty much, you're going to stay with your own label forever now, right? This is not.
I think so.
Right.
I don't see any reason not to do that.
Right. So do you just pretty much stay out of the music politics thing? Just do your own thing now?
Well, yeah, that's.
That's beautiful because, I mean.
That gets to be a part of it. You know, what I was looking for and what I want to do, Nestor, is do. What I want to do on my own terms with people that I feel real good about working with and not getting into a lot of the bullshit that I think it goes on in the record business.
Man, you're not kidding. 99 out of 100 bands and artists I talk to just complain and complain about the politics of the business and how, you know, when they started picking up a guitar and strumming it, this was not what they bargained for.
Well, you know, it is business.
Right.
And more, even at the radio station level, you have bankers who are buying radio stations. And so they turn it over to somebody or they turn it over to a specific format that's programmed out in L.A. or someplace. And it's hard to break through that. It's real hard to break through that.
Right. Now, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, you know, you have to be able to do the business to be in the business. But that doesn't mean that the business needs to run the creativity of it.
Okay. Now, what's in your future plan, just so I can tell your fans in you know, two paragraphs, okay, you have an album coming out in September, and what else?
I've got a Christmas special for CBS planned again this year. I've got a bunch of touring. I'm in the process. I did Earth Songs. Where that comes from is I did a re-recording of a bunch of songs that I had done over the years that were environmentally oriented.
Right.
Like Rocky Mountain High, Calypso, Eagle in the Hawk, Sunshine on My Shoulders. We re-recorded them, mostly the same arrangement. Some of them we played with a little bit, but we did it all digitally, recording, mixing, and mastering, and singing the way that I'm singing today. I'm singing differently than I did 20 years ago when I wrote some of those songs. And so that was a real nice project, and we're having fun with the acceptance of that. Those albums are not available in stores. And so I'm going to do the same thing with another album will be called Love Songs, and another album will be called Life Songs. And so that's going to take me into well into next year. And I'm trying to slow down a little bit, get a little bit more time at home, a little bit more time to myself, and not so much on the road.
Well, that's great. Well, I look forward to seeing you Saturday night. I really enjoy your shows. You're playing a brand new facility.
Yeah.
The place opens tomorrow night, as a matter of fact. So I think you're the third artist, and everything's brand spanking new, and it's right on the waterfront, so you might like
it. All right, I'm looking forward to it.
I look forward to seeing you Saturday.
All right.
Thanks, Sam. Bye-bye.